This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese's film Gangs of New York comes out on DVD and video next week. Scorsese grew up in Manhattan's Little Italy, a few blocks from the neighborhood that was once called Five Points, where the movie takes place. It focuses on the conflict between two gangs in Five Points, the Irish immigrants and the natives, who are Anglo-Saxons born in New York. Daniel Day-Lewis plays Bill the Butcher, the leader of the natives.
You know how I stayed alive this long? All these years. Fear. The spectacle of fearsome acts. If somebody steals from me, I cut off his hands. He offends me, I cut out his tongue. He rises against me, I cut off his head, stick it on a pike. Raise it high up so all in the streets can see. That's what preserves the order of things.
Terry spoke with Martin Scorsese in January. She asked why he cast Daniel Day-Lewis in the role of Bill the Butcher.
Ultimately, I think what I was really hoping for, and I think we've got, is a man of that period, a man who was so a warlord of that period, let's say. And many of these men were ex-pugilists. Most of them were ex-fighters, butchers, whatever. The butcher was looked upon by the working class and the lower classes as a sort of king of merchants in a way, and so he already had some power going in as a showman. And this is what I wanted: the theater piece, the showman, the man who, as he later says, conducts, or should I put it, commits fearsome acts with a sense of theatricality and a sense of humor, a charismatic leader. And this is what I wanted. And I knew that he would be able to find that. Although with him, he had pointed out last week we were talking, he pointed out that usually the character has to find him, has to let himself be known to him. And so he just becomes, after about 2 or 3 weeks, you find that whatever moves he's making, suggestions for an improv or something, is coming from the character who's now sort of permeating his being in a way. So when he talks to you, when he talked to me, like off camera or just even on the telephone, is no longer as Daniel, and it's not some magical process. It's just just happens to be the way he goes through it. And
when he starts talking to you as Bill the Butcher,
constantly. So even if it's a telephone on the holidays at dinner, and sometimes would make comments, particularly when he was in costume and off camera, he was definitely Bill, and comment about the. Of course, you know Daniel's Irish, but he would comment about the Irish, make comments about them on the set, stir up trouble that way to keep the energy going.
How do you respond to that, though, when you know somebody's talking to you in persona, and it's, in fact,
it's
a persona
easier.
You created? It's easier?
Oh, much easier. much
you
easier. You're dealing with the real thing. You're just going, okay, Bill, what do you think of this? Well, if you did that to me, I would have to do this. I see. True. But what if you went this way? And, I mean, it goes on, goes back and forth. It's actually cutting out a middleman.
It was
cutting out Daniel. It was just going straight
funny.
To Bill. It was fine with me.
Yeah, but what if he starts talking to you about, like, the weather as Bill the Butcher, or, you know...
That's what he did.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else you've worked with do that?
A couple of people, yeah. To a certain extent. I don't think as much as I encountered with Newland and Bill, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. His accent, where does that come from?
Well, we started working on the accents. Tim Monick is our dialect coach from Age of Innocence on, all my movies. And Tim got together with me, and we did some research with Daniel. And one of the first things he found was, of course, there's no recordings. There's a lot written in colloquial New Yorkese, so to speak. These plays in the Bowery about the Bowery boys in the 1840s and 1850s, 1860s. There's a lot on the written page. We see the way the words are written. Boyos is B-H-O-O-Y-S or something, or I may be wrong about that, but Gallus Mag and the names and the names of the people, and of course the jargon, or I should say they really had their own language. It was called the Rogues. It was written up in 1859 by an ex police chief into a collection called the Rogue's Lexicon. And we use a lot of those words in the film. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, we could have done more, but it was almost, you would have to have subtitles.
Yeah.
And so what Tim Monach first discussed was listening to a recording of Walt Whitman, the only recording of Walt Whitman, I believe, reciting four lines from one of his poems about New York. And one of the phrases was the ample streets of New York, if I'm not mistaken. But I know the word ample was in there. We say ample. Whitman said ample, apparently, on the wax disc cylinder, and which made a flat A. Then I remember Louis Auchincloss talking to me after Age of Innocence and talking about Mrs. Mingott character, who was based on Mrs. Jones, the original Mrs. Jones. And he said that they spoke in an odd way, said at times. He said, for example, Mrs. Jones would have said to her children, don't forget to take your poils, goyles. So then you got poils, goyles, ample. And it's suddenly becoming like New York cabbies in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
The Bowery Boys, you know. And so we went with that. And he started writing. I mean, he started reading. Daniel started reading the Bible aloud and working with an accent that way with Tim. So we created our accent based on what was written.
The opening scene in Gangs of New York is a battle scene in 1846 between Irish immigrants and the men calling themselves natives because they were born in America. Liam Neeson leads the Irish gang. Daniel Day-Lewis leads the natives. And they're fighting with knives and with cleavers. And in this
right.
fight sequence, particularly like Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays a butcher and a gang
yes.
leader,
yes.
he's walking around with this huge cleaver just kind of hacking
right.
away at people's legs.
Absolutely,
and it's,
yes.
It's gruesome. And I'm remembering back to a previous interview that you recorded on Fresh Air.
But we didn't say it was. I didn't say it was graphic, though.
No. But I'm interested in why you wanted to make it not graphic.
Yeah, because I made so many films over the years that deal with violence in a pretty flat, straightforward way.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know how else to do it except the way I did it in Mean Streets and Taxi Driver and Goodfellas and Casino. But by the end of Casino, the killing of Joe Pesci and his brother, and a string of killings in Las Vegas. I think it's very important to depict this lifestyle, and you have to show the downside, and this is the downside of it. And you have to be honest with it. I just think you have to be honest in the portrayal of violence, and not glorify it, but just put yourself in that position, and to understand the brutality of it, and particularly the killing, let's say, of Pesci and his brother at that point by his best friends, simply with bats. It was with baseball bats. The brutality is primeval, you know. And I think I don't want to make it stylish anymore, but I didn't want to fall into a cause and effect of a violent movement and you see the effect graphically. I wanted to suggest it with camera moves, camera speed, 48 frames, 64 frames, 12 frames, speeding up and down, going, starting a shot of 48, going to 12, then going to 24, back and forth, reverse it, that sort of stuff. And also through sound effects, but very little sound effects. So that I wanted to stylize, particularly the opening battle scene, based on, of course, you know, there's Orson Welles is the best battle scene ever in a film, Chimes of Midnight. And films I really, really like, I just enjoy watching the Russian cinema of the 1920s, Pudovkin, mm-hmm. particularly Eisenstein,
mm-hmm.
Dashenko, and a number of others. And so certain... There was one instance in Potemkin that I saw that was interesting. Again, I naturally everybody knows Potemkin and particularly the Odessa Steppe sequence. But I always remember the scene where a sailor is washing dishes and it says he comes to a dish. It says, "Give us this day our daily bread" on the dish, and he had just had the scene before had shown that they were feeding the sailors rotten meat, and the sailors were about to mutiny because of this, and. He was washing this dish. He's wearing a striped T-shirt. And he just looks at the dish, and cuts back to his face, looks at the dish, and then he smashes the dish. And I think there's maybe in the smashing of the dish, there's maybe 12 cuts. But the cuts I was interested in were the cuts of his arm, elbow, having had completed the motion of the breaking of the dish, the power in his arm. But it was after the action. And so this gave me an idea about different aspects of different parts of, let me put it this way, stunt moves, battle moves. In other words, I was more interested in not necessarily showing the...
The knife going into the wound.
Or... Yeah, exactly. But also wasn't it that interesting. I mean, basically, if it was all hand-to-hand combat, it should be done it should be done another way. In other words, there was no big surprise. The big surprise ultimately is when Bill the Butcher finally finds his way to Priest Valen. That's the surprise. Everything else, I was interested in the movement, and the creation of a kind of confused, futile, primeval world. Everything, just the futility of the fight itself. And you add to that the music that we put on, there was a piece by Peter Gabriel called Signal to Noise, which is pretty interesting, and I think you get a sense of what I was trying.
It's not giving away anything about the story to say that at the end of the film kind of dissolves and we see a modern New York skyline. We see a couple of New York skylines as they evolve. And in the final skyline, the World Trade Center is in it.
Yes.
So that's the final image that we see. Did you think of adding a post September 11th, post World Trade Center skyline?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, from way back in that very first draft, Jay Cox's draft in 78, 79, that was the way it ended. We knew that we were diehard New Yorkers, and it had to end with the skyline being built. It just had to. In fact, we had a second part of the story that we wanted to do, which was the building of the Brooklyn Bridge and how the bridge linked Manhattan to the rest of the country, or vice versa. And so it had to end with that. We just couldn't resist it. The thing about it, of course, that was we did that painting, series of dissolves and paintings before September 11th. Then right after it, I thought about it, and, you know, we're making a film. I felt that taking out the towers was not the right way to go. I felt we should leave them in. The people in the film, good, bad, or indifferent, were part of the creation of that skyline, not the destruction of it. And if the skyline collapses, ultimately we're aware of the struggle of humanity, if there's any left, building up another one. I think this is the sense of time going by, the sense of civilization changing, and primarily the idea of the city that we know now coming out of this extraordinary struggle, which not many people really know about. And so I felt it was more, I felt it would have been, not would have been right to go in and keep revising New York skyline in movies, erasing the two towers. That was the way I left it.
Martin Scorsese, thank you so much for
talking
with us.
Thank you.
Martin Scorsese speaking with Terry Gross this winter. Scorsese's film Gangs of New York comes out on DVD and video next week.